Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Court has three matters. Has three oral arguments this morning. And in the order that they will be presented, they are Lakeshore Utility Company, Incorporated, and others versus Texas Natural Resources Conservation Committee from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate District. In re Houston Northwest Partners Limited, an original petition for mandamus. Jeanette Gonzalez versus Reliant Energy Incorporated from Harris County and the 1st Appellate Judicial District. And Jeanette Gonzalez versus Reliant Energy Incorporated, also Harris County and the 1st Appellate Judicial District. And N. Ray Adel Shastawe, a petition for writ of habeas corpus. In the first and third matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. In the second consolidated matter, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument, and we've reallocated the sides as per their request. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of their allotted time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and we will conclude these arguments before our lunch break. Each argument is being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of an argument for a nominal fee from the clerk's office. We're ready to hear argument from petitioners in Lakeshore versus TNRCC.
May it please the court, Mr. Steve DeLon will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. My clients are Lakeshore Utility Company, Century Title Company, and Allen and Feldman Watley. I will refer to them as Lakeshore and the Lakeshore parties as I have in my brief. My clients, Lakeshore, are both petitioners and respondents in this matter. I guess I like some guidance from the court as to which issue the court or the relative importance that the court attaches to both of these issues. I think I can probably guess which one the court sees as the most important. For that reason, I think I am going to proceed first on the refund issue and whether or not the district court had the jurisdiction to award refunds in this particular case. I think the posture of this particular issue is somewhat confusing based on the briefs. The commission's brief on the merits basically argued that the commission had the statutory authority to seek an order of refunds at the district court level based on 13.411 of the Texas Water Code. In Lakeshore's response, we argued, one, that the commission did not have statutory authority under this particular statute, and two, that the district court did not have equitable jurisdiction to award refunds under its equity power. The commission had argued that in its brief on the merits, but it was almost as an afterthought. It was 3 pages of their 30-page argument. In the commission's reply to Lakeshore's response, the commission basically abandoned the statutory authority argument and said, in effect, that this case is not about the commission's statutory authority. It is about the district court's equity jurisdiction, whether or not the district court had the power to fashion an equitable remedy based on the facts of that case. So I think the way I see it as it stands now, the commission at least has abandoned the statutory authority argument and has put all of its eggs in one basket into the fact that this is a case, the issue is based on strictly whether the district court had the equity jurisdiction to grant an award of refunds. And that's what I'm going to address first, but I would seek the court's guidance as far as whether or not the court sees this also as a potential statutory authority argument.
Aren't they sort of inextricably intertwined? I mean, if you have the statutory authority, how far does the equity jurisdiction to enforce that authority go? I mean, I don't see them as entirely divorced.
I agree. I agree with that to a certain extent. I think where you're asking the question is, once the equity jurisdiction of the court is invoked by a statutory injunction, what equity power does the court have at that point? I think that originally this case was focused, and what the Court of Appeals focused on, was whether or not the statute itself granted express authority, or express or implied authority, to the commission to seek refunds through the district court. And I think the Court of Appeals correctly ruled that this statute, 13.411 of the Texas Water Code, did not grant the specific or rather express or implied authority for the commission to seek refunds at the district court level.
Could you phrase that also as an inability to retroactively require compliance? I mean, your reading is only prospective.
That's exactly right. And I think if you look at the statute itself, that's exactly, and the Court of Appeals basically said that the statute, 13.411, was unambiguous. 13.411 basically authorizes the commission to bring two types of actions. One, the first is an action to enjoin the commencement or continuation of any act that violates Chapter 13 of the Water Code or a rule or order of the commission. The other type of action is one to require compliance with Chapter 13 of the Water Code or a rule or order of the commission. Now, the power to bring those two types of action in district court are conditioned on if the commission has reason to believe that the facility is engaged in or about to engage in a violation of the code or a rule or order, or is currently failing to comply with the code or a rule or order. And the Court of Appeals, again correctly I believe, saw this statute as prospective in nature. It was addressing current violations or expected current violations or current noncompliance. It did not address past violations or past noncompliance. Those can be addressed in other enforcement areas of the statute and administratively by the commission. They are not addressed by Section 13.411 of the Water Code. And I believe that that's clear. This is a prospective statute. The commission would have it be read very broadly, and that to require compliance means that you can go back in time, in this case, as far back as almost 20 years, to, in their words, require compliance and require disgorge of overcharges from many, many years back for past noncompliance.
So under your reading, a utility would almost be encouraged then to charge rates that exceed the tariff, and as long as the action's pending, they can keep those profits until such time as a prospective order is issued. Where's the disincentive to go ahead and go beyond the tariff just until the court gets around to ordering it prospective?
Well, I think there are other procedures, there are other remedies that the commission has in its enforcement quiver that they can go after the utility that is overcharging. They can go after them administratively. They can put a trustee in charge. They can take over management of the business. There are potential criminal penalties for certain violations. There are other actions that they may take administratively and through the court that do not fall under this particular statute.
So they could require a refund administratively?
Administratively, they can require.
You're just saying that so if the commission had ordered the refund back to 1981, that would be enforceable in the district court?
The commission certainly
has. Which is what the Court of Appeals said.
Exactly. The commission has the power to require a refund. And in fact, twice in the 80s, they required Lakeshore. They entered orders requiring Lakeshore to make refunds. And though that was not under Section 13.411, 13.411 is entitled Action to Enjoin or Require Compliance. That is the statute that the commission is proceeding under. And that is the statute that we argue, and we believe the Court of Appeals was correct in holding, did not allow the commission to seek an order for refunds.
Is there a possibility of like a customer class action to get these refunds?
I think that's getting into whether or not there is an equitable remedy, whether the district court could fashion an equitable remedy. And certainly the customers would have.
I mean, take the PUC out of it. If the customers brought a private lawsuit against the utility over Athens, I don't know what county that is, but anyway, that's another enforcement mechanism.
Or I guess what I would term as an adequate remedy of law for the customer to go and sue the water utility in court for any alleged overcharges. Now, again, like I say, it appears that the commission is now arguing, and I agree that these are hard to separate, that the district court has equity jurisdiction to grant the refunds. And they are basically, or they base this or, and ask the court to use as instructive two U.S. Supreme Court cases, Porter versus Warner Holding, which is a 1946 case, and Mitchell versus Robert DeMario Jewelry, a 1960 case. And in both of those cases, a federal agency under a federal injunction statute sought, in the case of Porter, restitution of rents that were collected in excess of the maximum amount of rents that were allowed under the federal statute. And in Mitchell, the Secretary of Labor sought reinstatement of wrongfully terminated employees along with back pay and lost wages to those wrongfully terminated employees. And the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court in those cases held that once the federal district court's equity jurisdiction was invoked through a statutory injunction, it had all its equity powers available to fashion an equitable remedy that was warranted by the facts. And in that case, for example, I'll use the Mitchell case, it held that the employees were entitled to reinstatement and to back pay, and that those were equitable, federal equitable remedies. Now, those cases are distinguishable from the present case. In both, the Supreme Court, when the district court invoked its equitable jurisdiction, it balanced the equities for this additional equitable relief. The Supreme Court in Porter held that, to be sure, such a recovery could not be obtained through an independent suit in equity if an adequate legal remedy were available. In Mitchell, the court held that the wrongfully terminated employees effectively had no adequate remedy at law to pursue recovery of their lost wages in these circumstances. That is different from the case we have today. In this case, the commission, as the Court of Appeals held, can administratively order refunds. That is an adequate remedy in law. The customers, if they feel they're overcharged, can pursue a legal remedy in the courts. That is an adequate legal remedy. A statutory injunction does not require a balancing of the equities. Balancing of the equities has no application to a statutory injunction. The statute sets the terms and conditions of the injunction. If there are equities in favor of a utility, in this case, we don't balance the equities. The statute controls the injunction.
I take it the amount of refunds varies customer by customer, as found by the trial judge. The amount?
Yes.
What's the range?
What is the range in this case?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question offhand.
It must be around $1,000 a piece, just looking at the number.
Some are more than that, but some, I believe, are less. This is a different case because there is an adequate legal remedy. There is an adequate remedy for the commission to administratively impose an order for refunds. If there is an adequate legal remedy, equitable remedies have no application. Equitable remedies are imposed when there is not an adequate legal remedy. Statutory injunction is different because the statute controls whether or not the injunction is imposed or not.
Would there be any bar to a customer or anyone going before the TNRCC now and seeking a refund back in 1981? Is there a time limit? Is there...
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't believe that there is any statute of limitations against any administrative agency. However, I believe that there is a case that has come out fairly recently that goes along some type of a laches argument.
So if we were to determine that all the trial court could do in this proceeding was to order the refund from 1989 forward during the pendency of the rate increase request, then there'd be nothing to prevent the bringing of an action before the TNRCC for refunds back to 1981.
Not that I'm aware of. Another important point. This court has held that equitable remedies are not as broad, basically, as what the U.S. Supreme Court held in Porter and Mitchell. In the City of Beaumont versus Bullion and O'Brien versus the City of Midland, this court held that there was not a Bivens-type action for violations of the Constitution. In other words, there is not a private cause of action for money damages for violations of the Constitution. These cases did not prohibit equitable remedies for violations, private cause of action for equitable remedies for violations of the Constitution. but they did prohibit money damages, what they considered to be non-equitable remedies. And in O'Brien, a very similar case to the Mitchell case, the United States Supreme Court case in Mitchell, it involved police officers who were constructively discharged, who alleged they were constructively discharged for asserting their right to free speech. And the Austin Court of Appeals held, and it was affirmed by this court, that back pay or lost wages for these police officers was not equitable relief that could be sought for a constitutional violation. This court specifically held that reinstatement was an equitable relief that could be sought by the police officers in that case. In that particular case, a summary judgment had been granted at the trial court. District court has said you can't seek money damages, back pay, but you could seek reinstatement. That was affirmed by the Supreme Court, this court, in O'Brien. In O'Brien. That side's 949 Southwest 2nd 406. This court has basically held that equitable relief is narrower than what the court, U.S. Supreme Court's held in Porter and Mitchell. This court in Bullion and O'Brien basically held that equitable relief is limited to non-monetary relief. And that, applying that holding, those holdings to this case, the order for refunds would not be considered equitable relief. It would be considered money damages. I believe my time is just about expired.
Any other questions?
Is there any way that ordering the refund back to 1981 can affect the tariff?
The tariff? Are you talking about affecting today's tariff?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if a refund were ordered back to 1981, could it be the basis or subject matter of a new rate case saying that this retroactive refund is going to somehow affect future rates? I guess what I'm getting at is in a lot of these cases, we get the argument the PUC has exclusive jurisdiction if anything the district court can do would affect the tariff or the rate to be charged. And I haven't seen that argument in this case.
In this particular case, a new tariff has already been approved. I believe two tariffs since the 1977 tariff, and the most recent one was the year 2000-2001. I don't see how that could possibly have an effect on the rates that are approved now. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, the Assistant Attorney General, Mr. Linda Secord, will present arguments for respondent.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. Justice O'Neill, I think the answer to the question that you ended Lakeshore's opening with is this. It will affect the tariff if refunds are not ordered, because what's really going on in this case is retroactive rate making, which is prohibited. And let me see if I can make that answer a little more.
Let me just ask you this, then. If it will affect the rate, is an exclusive jurisdiction then with the TNRCC to determine the refund? If it relates to rate setting, then how does the district court have jurisdiction to touch it?
I think we're talking just a little bit at cross purposes, if I can unravel just a little bit. The exclusive jurisdiction that I think you're thinking about is the agency's exclusive jurisdiction to set the rate that the utility is allowed to charge. And the effect of no refunds being ordered, whoever orders them, setting aside the question for now of who's going to order them and who has jurisdiction, but if refunds are not ordered, then that 1977 tariff, which set them at a total of 800 and which was reaffirmed throughout the 1980s in all of the rate orders that the commission issued, will have been modified de facto by the utility giving themselves a self-proclaimed rate increase.
But again, doesn't that, since we're talking about effects of actions, if it affects rates, isn't that an exclusive utility PUC function? However it affects it.
The function that we have exclusive jurisdiction to do, we have done, which is to set the rate. The request of the require compliance from the district court is to get the utility back to that rate. That rate has not changed. That rate remained $800 total from 1977 until the time of trial.
I understand that, but if the district court orders the refund beyond the TNRCC's order, back to 1981, is there an argument that somehow future rates will be affected? I mean, my understanding is if rates are in any way involved or can be affected, then the TNRCC has exclusive jurisdiction.
Not if I'm understanding your analysis, no. It's that the rate has to be honored, and the legislature has given the agency the choice of asking the court to require that compliance. The rate does not change. The legal rate remains the same.
What's the choice, did you say? Going to court or doing it yourself?
We can keep it in-house. We have enforcement.
Why wouldn't you do that?
A variety of factors go into informing enforcement discretion. The nature of the violation, how long it's been going on, resources. There are lots of factors that go into an agency deciding whether they're going to keep it in-house and send it to SOA or go to district court. Remember, Section 13411A of the Water Code is the core enforcement provision, and it covers all the different kinds of wrongs that utilities can do.
Are there other instances where you've gone to court to get refunds?
This is the only one that I am aware of in which it has been necessary to go this far in order to get refunds. And this is
I guess we explored with the petitioner whether the customers could sue, but I suppose most of their claims would be time barred.
I assume that they would. There are two tables, Your Honor, attached to the judgment that show not just the customers and the refunds, but the dates. And I think most of them would be time barred. But that it's a good thing from our perspective that the customers will get their refunds if that portion of the third court's judgment is reversed. But that isn't why we went.
But this sort of does an end run around statute of limitations. It's an odd thing that customers couldn't get their own money from petitioner, but that the agency could get the money for them.
But our core purpose is not to get the money for the customers. Our core purpose is to get the utility back into compliance with the rate that the agency ordered and which they exceeded and gave themselves a raise without agency permission. And to have the customers do it themselves is to require individual solutions to what's a general problem, and it's the commission's problem. The legislature has directed us to set the rates and told us to make sure that they're obeyed, and empowered us in Section 13181, says we have all power of the state to ensure that utilities meet their obligations. Then when you go to Section 411A, we are specifically, expressly authorized and given the choice to go to district court. It is not correct that we have abandoned our statutory authority argument and focused on the district court argument. They are inextricably intertwined. This case isn't really about agency powers. It's about district court powers. But there's no question that the agency has been expressly authorized to go to court to seek an order requiring compliance with the Water Code, an agency rule, or an agency order. And what the Court of Appeals did was focus only on that third item and say, you have to have an order first. The Court of Appeals did not say, if I understand counsel's argument in opening, the Court of Appeals decision was characterized as saying that the district court does not have jurisdiction to order refunds. That is not my reading of the Court of Appeals opinion. What the court says is the district court can't do it absent an agency order commanding refunds. And we say that's backwards. That's backwards from the normal jurisdictional relationship of the agency and the courts. I mean, we see that the Water Code gives us a great deal of power and authority, but not over the district court.
Is it a question of primary jurisdiction, then, that because of the agency's expertise, it should first be sought before the PUC, before asking the trial court to, as an initial matter, impose?
Well, in this case, it was. That's the other thing that is troubling about the Court of Appeals opinion. It acknowledged but failed to appreciate the importance of the 1983 order commanding refunds. We have ordered them once in 1983 to make refunds of all monies collected above that 1977 tariff authorized amount, and they did not do it. When it was discovered in the course of this case that they had not done it, and that it had been going on for so long, the agency exercised its enforcement discretion and amended the existing petition and sought enforcement of the 1983 order.
Now, the 1983 order goes back to how far? I mean, do we need to reach the question of whether the trial court can only act on a PUC order? If there is one, we don't need to reach the question.
There are two arguments to be made as I read the 1983 order. There's an argument in favor of Lakeshore that it's time limited. It's only overcharges up through 1983. I say it doesn't have to be viewed that way, that there is until they have obeyed that 1983 order, there is a continuing obligation to make refunds, that the refund number is bigger now than it was in 1983, is the utility's choice to have continued overcharging and not have made the refunds. But that is another way, another ground upon which the Third Court of Appeals opinion can, and in our view, should be reversed, which is that we were seeking enforcement of the 1983 refunds order.
Ms. Seacard, excuse me a second. If we were to affirm the trial court and, in effect, go back to 1981 or whatever the date was, do you see any due process issues as far as notice, the right to contest those particular rates at that time?
Do you mean the customer's right to protest the rates at that time?
I mean likewise.
I do not, Your Honor, because the Lakeshore was a party to the 1983 proceeding that resulted from that order, and they did not appeal that 1983 order of refunds. They fully participated in the proceeding that led to it, and they did not seek its reversal.
Can you answer why it is not an adequate legal remedy for you to pursue those refunds administratively or through some other mechanism than suit in district court?
Well, we would say it isn't a legal remedy at all, that it is an equitable remedy, whoever orders it, agency or court. But more importantly, from a practical standpoint, Justice Jefferson, to require, as the Third Court has done, to hem us into only one path, which would be to create an order, and then if it's not obeyed, seek enforcement, would put us in a do loop, where there would always be I know you all do a lot of rate cases, and you're used to the concept of regulatory lag. Well, this would be an enforcement lag. There would be a do loop. Agency order issues commanding refunds. That order is not obeyed by the utility. Agency has to go to district court, get a judgment of district court. There will inevitably be a time period between the end of the agency order becoming final and its enforcement, its final judgment enforcement in district court. We will then have to start again and capture that gap. Now, hopefully, the gap will get ever narrower. But in a situation like this, where you have a utility that has persistently refused to obey the tariff rates, the orders to refund, then that enforcement array of options that the legislature gave us in Section 411A becomes particularly meaningful to the agency. And that's what happened in this case. The Third Court of Appeals.
Is there any limitation in time-wise? There was this original order requiring refunds was signed and issued in 1983. Is there any limit on how long you can wait to go into court?
There is no statute of limitations within the Water Code. It does not run against the state, and we are able to do that. But the Court of Appeals took the agency somewhat to task in its opinion about waiting so long, and I hope that my brief covers this adequately, but if it does not, let me say that the record in this case indicates that there was actually a very short period of time between the time the agency ordered refunds in January of 1983. Then 2 months later, in March of 1983, there was another proceeding in which Lakeshore was a party and fully participated, called the St. Paul Order, where the examiner's report said Lakeshore testified that they're charging more than's on their tariff. That's a violation of, and it sets out two sections of PURA that became the two sections of the Water Code. In 1984, they came back in, and on their 84 application indicated they were charging within the authorized range. So we did not, although statute of limitations does not run against the state, we don't have to rely on that argument. We did not know. We had every reason to think that they were charging within the authorized range. When those applications come in and it looks like the utility has heard the message of the examiner, the general response is good, good. They're back on the reservation again. They were not. It was not until the mandate from this court came back down, from the third court, sending back down the enforcement case to the district court, and the agency began getting ready for trial, that the extent of the tap fee overcharges was discovered. The 1989 order that was administratively appealed the proceeding that underlay that order did not involve tap fees. In 1981, Lakeshore sought an increase in its tap fee, and that was denied. That's the January 1983 order that I talked about. They started charging the rate that they had proposed as their new rate, and they were told no in the middle of that 1981 proceeding. There is a December 81 interim rate order of the examiner that puts them back to the 1977 tariffed amount of $800. They kept charging. They went through the St. Paul order. They kept charging. They kept charging all the way up to the time of trial, not just 1989. They have appealed the violations occurring during the 1980s, because during that time period the statute required that for a civil penalty to be attached, the violation had to be knowing. And so that's why that's what they've appealed. But they overcharged all the way through. And we submit that that is exactly the kind of situation that the legislature intended for us to exercise our enforcement discretion and say, we are tired of fooling with this.
Do you think...
We are in court.
Is this power shared by other state agencies, do you think? Or does it depend on the organic statute?
Oh, I think it has to depend on the organic statute.
PUC might or might not be able to do it, or can other state agencies go to court and seek enforcement of their orders the same way you're doing in this case?
If they have in their organic statute something that reads like Section 411A, that I would say they would be able to. But my understanding is that agency powers and district court powers are mirror images of each other. We have what the legislature has given us. The district court has everything unless the legislature has expressly taken it away. So I would say that an agency would need to have enforcement authority in its statute, and it would also have to have within that enforcement authority the kind of language we have that says you may go to court to require compliance.
Ms. Secord, you've characterized the remedy of refunds that you're seeking as an equitable remedy, irrespective of which entity orders it. Address Lakeshore's argument that you have, therefore, abandoned the argument that you have legal recourse under the statute, and that you're only seeking equitable recourse under the statute.
I don't think I understand Lakeshore's argument, because legal remedy, I think as they're using it, is a sort of catchword for the dividing line between what a court can order at law, money damages, and what a court can order at equity, which will sometimes include money, if it's money that has to be restored. So we have not abandoned our argument that we can go to court and seek equity, but our argument is that we have the legal authorization from the legislature to make that request. I have the sense that I'm not on the program with you, Justice Wainwright.
Well, under 13.411, as I understood part of Lakeshore's argument, it was contended that the commission was seeking its recourse based on the inherent equitable authority of a court, not based on a specific legal right under that statute. Are you seeking your remedy under one, either one or both?
Okay. I don't know if this is I don't know if I've got your question quite right, but I think I know where we're going. Porter is our case. And Porter talks about and parses out the idea that there are common law cause of action for injunctions and statutory. And I think that's where the dots get connected, Hope, for your question, is our position is that we have that statutory kind of injunctive relief request.
But would you say that the statutory language require compliance gives you the legal remedy in court, and that if you're seeking disgorgement of profits, that's the equitable remedy you seek for the legal violation?
We would say that the entire thing was an equitable remedy, because require compliance is going to require an order of the court in equity. It's going to have to be a writ of injunction that runs against a real person. The legal remedy would be, when courts of equity sit to see whether there's an adequate legal remedy, they're looking to see whether there are money damages available, and that is not something that's applicable in this kind of case.
Well, the statute reads, in part, that there's authority to enjoin the commencement or continuation of any act or to require compliance with this chapter. I think, in part, Lakeshore's arguing that language means that you only have authority on refunds going forward, prospectively. Where's the authority? Is it from the statute or from the inherent authority of the court, in your opinion, to seek refunds going backwards in time as opposed to prospectively?
It comes from both places, Justice Wainwright. The require compliance language, the metaphysics of this, to my way of thinking, have to be that the require compliance language looks backward to past things that the utility has done wrong, which of course have to be corrected in the future. But it also encompasses the inherent authority, all of the inherent equitable jurisdiction of the court. But require compliance is going to have to look backwards. There's a great case that comes out of Texas that isn't...
Ms. Secret, let me make sure I understand you. So the language that we're talking about in 13.411, subsection A, regarding enjoining the commencement or continuation of any act, do you agree that that's important language here?
Yes, I do.
You think that language does not necessarily suggest that there's only authority for these matters going forward? I don't think the language is limited to that when it says commencement or continuation.
Yes, and it's in the nature of a prohibitory injunction, which stops somebody who is doing something right now, which Lakeshore was.
So then, is equitable authority necessary for you to then seek refunds going backwards in time, in your opinion?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's why you say your action combines both.
Yes, Your Honor. And the require compliance language is the retrospective language. There are two things.
Without the statutory authorization, would you concede that respondent is right under Bullion and O'Brien? I mean, the petitioner's right under Bullion and O'Brien, that the courts would not have this power?
We do not see those cases as being applicable, because those are cases that look to the whole line of cases where this court has said there's no constitutional tort. But yes, we've got to have 411A to go to court.
Let me ask you just a basic question. These so-called refunds, these are going to the state general fund. They're not going to in any way make their way back to the customers.
They are going to the customers.
Okay.
They do not go to the commission. They go back to the customers. What the commission gets out of this is that our rate is honored. The tariff now will become effective. The statute says that they cannot charge, collect, or receive any amounts beyond what we have authorized. Those amounts have to be uncollected from them. But the amounts go to the customers. We do not get that money. The general fund does not get that money. What we get is our regulatory authority is honored, and our and the utility is brought back into compliance with that rate.
But all factual determinations will be made by the trial court as to whether there's compliance or not, not by the commission. Is that correct? In other words, you will litigate in a district court whether the tariff, in fact, has been complied with.
That is correct. And that is the nature of a statutory injunction brought by the government. And this whole business of no equity jurisdiction is incorrect, as we set out in our brief. What we have to do in that kind of injunctive request is we prove the facts that show that they're not, that they are violating the statutory standard that the legislature set. And so the court is still doing equity and has its inherent equity powers. It's just that, as Magnolia Petroleum and Texas Pet Foods state, there are no equities to balance in a situation in which the legislature has already established the standard.
Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court. I believe that one way that I would clarify the issue on the statute is if Lakeshore's violations, alleged violations from our point of view, obviously, had continued to, say, 1995 and stopped, then there are no continuing violations, there are no current violations, there are no potential violations under which the commission could have gone to court under Section 13.411. They could not have used 13.411 to address past violations and past noncompliance. They can only do it when it's current violations. It's a very skewed reading of this statute. It takes a long stretch to say that this statute can be used to address past violations. Another point I want to raise is we've talked a lot about tariffs and tariff rates. The rates that the commission is referring to are in a portion of the tariff. It's called the schedule of rates. It would have a sewer tap and a water tap. That is not the only piece of the tariff. The tariff also includes rules, extension policies, and service rules that are basically boilerplate language that the commission requires to be in tariffs. These, for example, the extension policies in the tariffs specifically states, individual residential customers who place a unique or non-standard service demand on the system may be charged the actual cost of any additional collection or pumping facilities required over and above the standard requirements.
Where does it say they can do that outside the tariff?
That is inside the tariff. That is contained within the tariff.
But you have to go to the commission to get permission for that, not just make your own decision and hope it never comes up for review.
I don't believe that's correct. The tap fee definition, the commission's rules of tap fee in 1989, basically gave a definition of tap fee and ended with other charges such as extension fees or contributions in aid of construction are not to be included in the tap fee.
There was those fees have to still be approved. The utility can't just decide sui sponte, we're going to charge this fee outside the tariff. All fees the utility charge have to be within or expressed or approved in the tariff.
Not according to this. The tariff would have the scheduled rates for a general tap fee, but there has to be some flexibility. You can't have, if there are 10 different size pumps and 10 different charges that would be charged to customers, there has to be some flexibility in the system, and there was in the tariffs at that time, and continues to be to this day. How much can be charged?
Haven't you known for almost 20 years that the commission doesn't agree with that reading?
The Lakeshore has known since 1989 that the commission does not agree with its interpretation that these pressure affluent systems were not non-standard systems. 95% of the systems in Texas are gravity flow systems. Less than 5% are the pressure affluent systems. All of Lakeshore's are pressure affluent because of its proximity to the lake and the need to pump up to the stations. In 1989, the commission came forward finally for the first time and said, these are standard within the Lakeshore system. So they are standard systems, and therefore you cannot charge additional fees in addition. because it's nonstandard. That's the first time Lakeshore is aware of it. That was upheld by the Court of Appeals in 1994, saying that this interpretation was not an unreasonable interpretation.
If the commission has the authority to seek refunds under this statute, if we think that, because of fashioning equitable remedy in these circumstances, do you still argue that that remedy should not include prejudgment interest and attorney fees? Or do you think that once they can get there to get refunds, they can get those things as well?
Well, I have a hard time seeing how they could ever get to the refunds, but and I would argue that no, they can't seek prejudgment interest and attorney's fees. Part of the prejudgment interest would be why there is a time constraint. Why have they taken so long? And the fact that they have argued that, well, Lakeshore has been basically lying to us, I believe is certainly untrue. The tap fees on their rate applications all say the tap fees are the average of the standard residential connection. Lakeshore considered these to be non-standard residential connections.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the first calls, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.